Global demographic changes refers to shifts and trends in the composition, distribution, and characteristics of population around the world. Now, these changes are influenced by various factors, including fertility rates, mortality rates, migration patterns, and socioeconomic factors. However, there's nothing which has more of an impact on demographic patterns than mankind and the choices of the most powerful and elite. I'm Skynell Hughes, and this is 360 View. Let's get started. To help us discuss global demographic trends and what the influencing factors are, we are joined by Bradley Sherman. Now, Bradley is founder and CEO of The Super Age, a global strategic research and advisory firm helping public and private organizations understand the challenges and harness the opportunities of demographic change with a focus on the population who is aging. He's also the author of The Super Age, How Longer Lifespans Are Changing Everything We Know About Work, Life, and Learning. And he was also a co-founder and managing partner of Economy 4, where he led business development in Asia and Europe and served at the AARP, the world's largest organization dedicated to improving the lives of older people, where he was actually the director of global partnership and engagement. Welcome, Bradley. Quite the resume that makes you an expert in this area. So I want to start off. Do you see a difference in what has impacted major global demographic shifts from the past and what we're seeing today?
This is the first time in history where populations are aging as fast as they are. In fact, in many countries now, one in five people is over the age of 65. But aging is just the prelude to population contraction, which is actually happening in a number of the world's biggest economies, including Russia, China, and Japan. So we're dealing with a lot of dynamics right now that are really upending what we consider to be normal, the normal world and a normal economy. And because of that, we have to shift our thinking about who's able to work, when they can be consumers, how we engage people in society as a whole, and whether or not GDP is really the only measure for society's success.
So it all comes down to the dollar.
Always comes down to the dollar.
No matter what, even in this case. Okay, so what do you find to be the most positive reason for a trend like this to happen? And we're gonna start with the positive side.
There's always positives. The 20th century is a success story. We extended human longevity during the 20th century in large part because we took care of kids. Once we were able to keep kids alive, they were able to reach adulthood. They were able to get to old age. We built these wonderful social welfare systems. The economy grew dramatically. These are all positive things. These are things we should herald as successes of our society. The challenge is that we haven't adjusted them to accommodate what we call the new longevity. The fact that a majority of people now will live into their 60s and 70s, and a good number of people will live into their 80s now as well. Believe it or not, people over the age of 80 are the largest and fastest growing demographic in the world.
That's incredible compared to the past on the side of it.
Exactly. Most people didn't get there.
And we're not ready for it, as you say. In what area do you feel like we're the least prepared?
Probably in the care sector. That seems to be the one that everyone focuses on right now, because population change involves two things. The one is the aging of the population, this longevity dividend that we're getting here. But also, we're having fewer babies. And we've been having fewer babies now for about 25 years. Well, those children are now adults. They're working. And there are simply not enough of them to go around. So what's happening in our economy more broadly is that the lack of workers or the inability for people to businesses to fill jobs is causing inflation to rise. The fewer people that we have mean fewer people to take care of those older adults that might be in need. So it is a bit of a challenge, and we're trying to muddle through it right now. No one has the right solution quite yet.
Could we have been better prepared for this? I mean, we knew that people were going to get older. They were living longer. Right. Could we have actually done a better job of basically setting up the infrastructure beforehand?
Sure we could. But we have to remember that we like to wait. We like to wait until there's an actual crisis at hand. Believe it or not, demographic change grew up with climate change. They're siblings. They're byproducts of the Industrial Revolution. Could we have done something to mitigate climate change 25 years ago? Yes. Did we? No. The same holds true for demographic change. We knew this was coming. It's been coming now for 25 years. In fact, birth rates have been declining now for about 200 years, with the exception of the baby boom. These are long-term trends. We are well aware of them, and we chose to do nothing.
So there are many countries who are experiencing an increase in the proportion, like you said, of older adults due to declining fertility rates and improved health care. What effect do you think this demographic shift not only poses to health care, but also the pensions and the social support system that these governments are going to be expected to take care of these people when the business, the private sector, can't?
Well, I think within the health care sector, we're going to look at radical transformation, literally overnight. Because everyone who's anyone is throwing money into this right now because they know it needs to be fixed. We don't have enough bodies to take care of the people that are there. With the economy more broadly, I think we have to look at a future that's much more inclusive. We talk through inclusive through the lens of diversity in terms of gender, race, sexual orientation, gender identity, but we rarely include older adults in this conversation. If we think about the fact that we're not only living older, and longer, but we're also living healthier, that means that we have extra years that we should be working, we should be contributing. That's an exciting thing, but we tend to shut people off at 65. Why would we shut people off at 65 when they have at least, you know, 10, 15, 20 years of good, healthy years ahead of them? It's kind of ludicrous. We're cutting out possible workers and possible consumers from the economy.
Okay, so while the global age, as you mentioned, might be actually increasing, the fertility rates are also declining globally, resulting in low birth rates, smaller family sizes. Do you think this could also be a good thing? You mentioned climate change, and why do you think this is happening?
You know, climate change, there's theories that climate change fits into this somehow. Lower sperm counts for men, for example. There's also the reality that our life course has changed. People used to have babies in their teens and their 20s. Now they have them in their 30s and their 40s. In fact, women over the age of 40 are the fastest growing group of moms in the world right now. That's pretty different. And when you start late, you're more likely to have fewer children too. But what does this mean globally? Well, literally every country you go to today, I don't care what the geography is, the birth rate is in decline. Now, it's different from place to place. In a country like Niger, every woman on average is having 6.89 children. Can you imagine?
Right.
But if you go to South Korea, which has the lowest birth rate in the world, they're having 0.78 children per woman. So it's a radical difference in terms of where babies are being born and where populations will grow versus where populations will actually contract.
What do you think is the impact on this, or why is this happening? I mean, is it because of the economy, because the economic systems you're mentioning can handle it? Lower income countries are having more, which basically right. puts on the backs of those that are of other countries.
Perhaps. You know, what caused demographic change to happen? Well, we can look at a number of different variables. The first and foremost is probably urbanization and the industrial age. The idea of a family farm that you actually needed children to work on. Children were economic tools back then.
They still should be, by the way.
To some degree.
I just want to point that out.
Well, I think you can find that in Arkansas right now, as the governor has actually lowered the age for people to work down to 14. Well, my grandfather entered the coal mines at the age of 14. I don't think we're going in that direction
yet. I was
going to
say, is this a good thing? Because, I mean, there was a reason why we took the children out of the coal mines at 13 and 14 and put them in school.
Exactly. We believed in investing in youth because investing in youth was the future. Well, what we did with all of these interventions, getting kids out of factories, getting them off the fields, making sure they had a stable food supply, making sure they had clean water, all of these contributed to children moving from a 1 in 2 chance of dying before the age of 18 to a nearly 90-95% chance of surviving into adulthood. These are all good things. But what that did during that period was explode the global population. We went from about 2 billion people to 8 billion people today. That is a disruptive change. Now, as we go into this new era, we're actually looking at a more historical norm for society where we'll have slow growth in some nations, plateauing in others, and some decline in others too. We are still growing here. We are still growing here in the United States. We're growing because our birth rate isn't too off. It's at about 1.7. It needs to be at 2.1 to keep population steady, but we still have immigration here. Immigration is the story of America, and as long as people are coming in, the country continues to grow.
Well, you mentioned that we do have immigration here, but these are coming from less well-off countries that are still continuing to produce mm-hmm. more than just the one child that the Americans feel like they can hold.
Correct.
So are we kind of setting ourselves up on this railroad to disaster because, to a certain extent, we can't afford. The reason why people are not having more children, I believe, here in America or in the Western countries, is because they can't afford to have more children.
It's in part because they can't afford to do it. That's what a lot of people focus their energies on, is the cost of having a child. And my God, it is expensive. But the reality is people have more choices now than they did 100 years ago. Women are educated. Women have the right to vote. Women have the right to work. That changes the dynamic. We can have access to birth control, and yes, even abortion and preventative births. So when you take all of these things together, women are more in the driver's seat of their reproductive health, choosing or not to choose to have children. They're also economically viable. They're no longer dependent on a man. They're no longer the primary caregiver or the primary homemaker anymore. So because of that, the dynamics is simply turned around. What does this mean for the future? Well, not much. We've been on this trajectory for over 200 years of declining birth rates. I don't see it turning around anytime soon, unless we go back to an agrarian society. And a society that's very, as we say, traditional values, where the man is the breadwinner, the woman is in the house, and she takes care of the kids in the home.
It's interesting that you bring that, because this is a perfect transition, because post-coronavirus, we saw a major exodus from the urbanization. You saw people moving out of the cities. Are we seeing a reverse that has been happened because of something like a global pandemic?
Yeah, we saw a reverse, but they were typically reverses to nearby rural areas. So District of Columbia is a great example, because if you go out maybe as far as Richmond, down into in Southern Virginia, maybe the Tidewater region, you can get here by train. Same for New York City, people going up into the Hudson Valley, perhaps onto Long Island, it's easy to get to. But in 3/4 of our counties, most of which are rural, populations are in decline. Deaths outpace births. So it isn't a full reversal. Also, I think as people are coming back to the office, and yes, they are, despite what people want, they are getting pulled back into their office place. This is moving the needle back to people coming into the cities. You just have to look at housing prices in major markets to know that there's demand to live in these places.
Okay, so let's tie this back into how we started this conversation, this segment about the aging population. Sure. Knowing all of this, did we find that elderly population, that they moved into the cities as well, or did they stay where they were at, and how are those communities handling it?
It's a mixed bag. Boomers are a very large population, or have been historically, 76 million at one time. Now they're down to about 69 million in total. There was a move of older adults, boomers in particular, back into cities. But the largest percentage of boomers are still living in the suburbs. And this is problematic because 8 out of 10 people want to stay in their home. Suburbs typically don't have the right infrastructure in place to take care of an aging population. They don't have the right transportation services. They don't have the right social services. All of these things are missing from the equation. In a city, though, where you live in a 15-minute neighborhood, I live just so north of here in Logan Circle, and I can get to 3 grocery stores within 3 blocks. These are essential services that neighborhoods need in order for people to live and age well.
Okay, so now we look at these boomers as they're leaving these homes kind of in the suburbs. Do you think that they're going into retirement homes? Where are they going?
Everyone will enter, most likely will enter nursing care at some point. There isn't a preponderance of people going into care settings if they don't have to. People tend to go into care settings when they're forced to. They have a fall or a major health event. Perhaps they lose a spouse and become somewhat isolated and move to abate that in some way. But the reality is if you can stay at home, you want to stay at home. And most people want to do that. The good news is there are minor interventions that people can make in their own homes to make them livable for longer periods of time, where you can actually build that runway for your independence for longer periods of time. And these are minor modifications, and they actually look really nice. You can hide them in the design of a kitchen or a bathroom, improving the lighting schemes, making sure basic things like the corners of carpets and rugs are taped down so there's no trip potential there. But eventually we all have to deal with the reality, or most of us have to deal with the reality that we need care. We will need care at some point at the end of our lives.
And is this happening? We talk about trends, but global trends. Are you not only seeing this in Western countries like the United States, the UK, but you're seeing this in other countries? Are they following the same sort of line that the West is? Is this something that we can all actually agree on is happening?
Yeah, it's a pretty universal thing. But again, because aging and longevity are tied to industrialization, talking about modern economies. Obviously, if you go into economies that are still developing, primarily those in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, or perhaps Latin America, people are still living in multi-generational housing. They're living with their grandparents.
Which means they're better off. They're kind of going back to what you're encouraging people to do, is to keep it home.
And believe it or not, it's happening here in the United States too, albeit very slowly and just underneath the surface. From about 1971 till today, there has been a trend to go back into multi-generational living within one house. It eases the care burden on all parts of the family. Grandparents can take care of grandkids. Adult children can take care of their parents. It really gets us back to a more harmonious way of living, but also a more traditional way of living, too. Because prior to the 20th century, that's how everybody lived.
Right. Okay, so then you're talking about that. What is the future? Do you feel about, when we're talking about boomers leaving their homes open, do you feel like this is going to have an impact on millennials, that might give them a better chance to own homes for the first time?
It does. It gives them a big chance. In fact, boomers hold about 40% of assets in real estate. They own about 40% of the real estate market in this country. When they start exiting the real estate market, those homes will become available to more people that might have been kept out of the marketplace. This is a good thing for millennials. It's an even better thing for Gen Z. The short-term thing that's happening right now is something we call the great wealth transfer. The great wealth transfer is the move of assets from boomers to their progeny, to their children. These are typically late Gen Xers, like myself, and early millennials. And what that's doing is it's giving this extra influx of cash into the marketplace that wouldn't exist otherwise. Think of it like a private sector stimulus. So all of a sudden, these adult children that are millennials and boomers that got these gifts from their parents are buying real estate, pushing up the prices even further. So in the next, let's say, 10 to 20 years, we're going to see some destabilizing in the real estate market. Perhaps not in major cities, but certainly in rural counties, and certainly in smaller cities across the country too. Unless, of course, there's a really transformative piece of technology that allows us actually to work from home 24 hours a day.
Thank you, Bradley Sherman. Because after the break, we're going to actually continue this discussion as it's fascinating, and look at whether some world governments are actually manipulating demographic trends for their own benefit and at the detriment of others. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Rick Sanchez. And I'm here to plead with you, whatever you do, do not watch my new show. Seriously, why watch something that's so different? Why listen to opinions that you won't get anywhere else? Look, if it pleases you to have the State Department, the CIA, weapons makers, multi-billion dollar corporations choose your facts for you, go ahead. Why change? And whatever you do, don't watch my show. Stay mainstream, because I'm probably going to make you uncomfortable. My show is called Direct Impact. But again, you probably don't want to watch it, because it might just change the way you think.
NATO has made it clear it deems its Ukraine proxy war against Russia as existential. As such, Russia too sees the conflict as existential. It could not be otherwise. There will be no negotiated end to this conflict. One side will lose. The smart money is not on Biden or NATO.
With the discovery of the New World at the end of the 15th century, there appeared Atlantic slave trade. The slave traders from European countries started building forts on the western coast of the African continent to transport the African inhabitants to America to be forced into hard labor. Until the middle of the 17th century, Portugal had played the main role in this atrocious business. Then Great Britain, France, and the Netherlands took the leadership. For the span of 400 years of legal and illegal slave trade, about 17 million people were forcefully shipped across the Atlantic, not including those who died on the way due to unbearable living conditions. Modern historians estimate that for each slave shipped to America, there were five who died while captured, during transportation, and cruel obliteration of rebellion. This ruthless people trade practiced by the leading European countries took away tens of millions of African lives. The Organization of United Nations classifies the transatlantic slave trade as one of the gravest human rights abuses in the history of humanity. This is the biggest act of deportation of people ever seen by mankind.
Welcome back. You know, we're going to continue our discussion about global demographic trends with our expert, Bradley Sherman. Bradley, I want to go back to this idea of immigration. Do you feel that some of the policies of some countries are purposely driving out certain demographics into other regions? Now, these groups are usually, like I said, the most poor, less educated. You know, I have all the various world agencies that we have. Do you think there should be more of a watchdog on those receiving these immigrants rather than the accountability for the countries that seem to be pushing them out?
You know, immigration is a really sticky, weird issue that we all get kind of consumed with because there are no good answers. Obviously, people are leaving for a multitude of reasons. Whether or not people actually get pushed out, I don't think there's really good data on that, getting pushed out into other places. We are starting to see, obviously, the first climate refugees, island nations that are starting to move. But the reality is that we live in a global world now. And the question is whether or not we're able to take in these folks into our own countries and make them part of, you know, who we are in the future.
But is the question, are people not staying in their own country? The ones that are leaving are usually the ones that are not necessarily respected or taken care of within their own society.
That's not necessarily the case. I mean, we bring in a lot of really high-level, high-educated immigrants to this country. In fact, there are specialized programs
usually
just for
legally,
that.
Though. But the ones that we're looking at the southern border, a lot of the ones that are doing this, of the non-legal way of doing it, are the ones that I feel like are being pushed out because of government policies in their own countries. Well,
definitely government policies. And the government policies are on a multitude of things. Like, they don't have good social welfare protection, for example. But they also might not have economic opportunity. Government policy also might affect...
Which is caused by government policies.
Correct. Government policy might also affect how in certain nations in Latin America or Central America in particular are dealing with drug dealers,
right,
in particular, the cartels. And if people feel unsafe, they're coming here. So, yeah, it does come back to government policy in a major way, because if you're living in a safe, prosperous
nation...
You're
not going to leave it.
Why would you leave?
Right.
Why would you leave? Of course, you know, one of the subnotes here is that one of the micro trends that I'm looking at very closely right now is the emigration of Americans to Europe. It's a small number right now.
Over to the UK. I've been reading where you see a lot of exodus of Americans to London.
Yes, but it's not just London. It's Southern Europe. It's Germany. They've liberalized their labor laws over there, so it's a bit easier for us to move. They have no gun violence. And they have wonderful social protection. So we're starting to see Americans take Europe up on this offer. And Europe wants to have them, because if they can get highly qualified, highly educated individuals in, they keep their societies flourishing. Because people who are high income are always going to pay high taxes.
Which is amazing, because I think that, and from the American standpoint, the immigrants that are coming in, especially southern border, are the ones that don't have those economic opportunities. But the ones that are leaving the United States are the ones that you would like to actually retain.
There's an irony there. So,
yes,
you know,
very much so.
There's always a country that's better than another.
Right.
There's very rarely one that always sits at the top. There isn't one that sits at the top now, period.
That's interesting.
There's still a great value proposition here, to put it in business parlance. There's still a great value proposition for immigrants in particular to come here. It's still seen as a land of opportunity for many.
Well, that's what we're talking about, because is the world more ethnic, racially diverse than prior civilizations have had with these trains? And why does this seem to be causing, in some cases, more conflict than being celebrated?
There's a couple of different ways to look at it. Probably the easiest one is through the lens of race and culture. America's foundational culture was enslaved people brought from Africa and primarily European, Christian, or Jewish immigrants. That's what made up America. Now, the Americas really become very diverse, and there are populations from Latin America, from Africa, from the subcontinent, from Asia, that have really come in recent years and changed the makeup of this country. Generation Z is the most diverse generation we've ever had.
That's in America, though. What about in China, in even Africa? You're not seeing that sort of diversity that is occurring. And so are you seeing those demographic trends and those shifts happening like what you're seeing in the U.S.?
Take a look at China. China does not have large numbers of people going there. People aren't interested in moving to China. It's still an authoritarian government. It's still controlled by the state.
Or they don't allow it. They really just don't allow immigration.
But it's also monocultural. And so monocultural, with such a dominant racial group at the top, the Han, that it's very hard even for Chinese minority groups that exist within the country, 80 or so of them, to actually find a place within that society. It's not welcoming to foreigners. You're always an outsider. The same is true in a place like Japan. A place like Korea is opening up a little bit more. Africa, not really. They actually get some immigrants from China in Africa now. But for the most part, there are places in the world where people don't go. They're not interested in moving to. Typically, people want to move to Western, highly industrialized, social democratic countries. That's what they want. We're the gold standard.
Well, that's it. Okay, so last question I have to ask you. What is going to happen to these advanced nations if people don't start having more kids? Mm-hmm. Are they still going to be advanced? And should we be doing more to encourage than necessarily?
There's two sides to the coin. Having more children would take some of the burden off the healthcare system, for example, would continue to gin up the economy. But it also puts more people into the pot that are drawing down resources. And we know that we're living in a time where we're resource poor. It's harder and harder each year to take care of the global population. We're taking more from the earth than we can give back. I think on the other side of the coin, though, what can Europe do? Europe has to manage their transition very carefully. They need to increase older worker participation. They need to look at immigrants as a stopgap solution. Technology becomes very important in the coming years. They can protect what they have if they make the change now. If not, and you probably remember this argument from Russia during the Soviet era, guns are better. Well, we're going to have to choose guns or old people. Some countries are not going to be able to pay for their defense in the future if they have to deal with these social welfare commitments.
Whole another show on that one. Bradley, thank you so much for joining
us.
Very insightful on everything. Thank you so much. And you can find more about Bradley's work by checking out his latest book, Decoding Our Demographic Destiny, The Super Age. Now, understanding global demographic changes is crucial for policymakers, social planners, and governments, all to anticipate and address challenges related to healthcare, social security, labor markets, and infrastructure. Now, these changes also have implications for economic development, cultural dynamics, and social structures at the global and national levels. Accurate predictions of where these trends are going can help shape policies, which have a negative or a positive effect on the shifting demographics of a region. It isn't rocket science or even magic to foresee what the future holds. However, those in power too often make decisions for short term, knowing they will not have to deal with the long-term ramifications. I'm Sky Nell Hughes, and this has been your 360 view of the news affecting you. Thanks for watching.